Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 276. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can, of course, follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And go to the Facebook. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a jam-packed show for you this week. We must get started. I am going to tip my hand and say this is going to be one of those intros that does not do our guest justice, but I'm going to try it anyway. Tracy Baim is the publisher and executive editor at Windy City Media Group, which produces the Windy City Times, Night Spots, and other gay media. She co-founded Windy City Times in 1985 and Outlines newspaper in 1987. She is the author, co-author, editor of like 90 books, I counted, including Gay Press, Gay Power, Obama and the Gays, Out and Proud in Chicago, The Half-Life of Sergeant Jen Hunter, and a ton more. In 2013, she produced a 2,400-question LGBTQ trivia game called That's So Gay, unaffiliated with our show. This helps counter the negative comments about the community. She has won numerous community and journalism honors, including the Community Media Workshop's Studs Terkel Award in 2005, an induction into the Chicago Gay and Lesbian Hall of Fame, and just this year, the Lifetime Achievement Award for Excellence in Chicago Journalism. Seriously, I could do this bio for the whole hour, but we would never get a chance to speak. Tracy, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you for having me on, Ken.
I was trying to fit in there somewhere, so I'll just say it now. I didn't even mention the MVP of Chicago's 1993-1994 indoor soccer season.
I used to play soccer. I'm a little too old. My bones won't let me anymore, but I do miss it.
Where does that award rank with everything else?
Well, I have to tell you, I think soccer in my life made a massive difference, because as a teenage girl in this society, learning how to play team sports in the 1970s and 80s was really, it actually, I think it made me who I am today. Title IX changed the world for women in this country. So I have to say that soccer saved my life.
Look at that. I didn't even know if that was going to be like a metaphor, but it was like a real thing.
Yes.
I love it. Now, I have to ask you, were your ears burning? Because, my gosh, were we extolling your virtues last week with Sarah Toche?
Yeah, she's amazing. It was kind of an accidental meeting that I ever met her. I mean, she's in Seattle. We're in Chicago. But I was on a tour, I think, in around 2009 or so for the movie Hannah Free that I produced.
Yes.
It was coming through Seattle. And so that's how we kind of connected. So, you know, sometimes you don't know what projects you do that lead you into meeting very fascinating people.
Well, I don't want to trigger some sort of, you know, order of protection, restraining order, but your name has come up a lot over the past 7 years. Do you have a sense of your place in this landscape? Because you are justifiably so revered across the board.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where I operate mainly in Chicago, and I mainly operate with the LGBT community of Chicago. So this is my 30th year working in that realm. And so for the last decade or so, it feels like finally, you know, the work of the LGBT community, and especially LGBT journalists, is being more respected in the mainstream. Maybe that's because the mainstream's going down in flames too, so we're all in this boat together. But
right.
I think, so I felt like in the recent years there's been far more, not tolerance, I hate the word tolerance, but inclusion of our community, and therefore those of us who have been in the niche, have really felt like our work is being seen more. Partly that's the internet, of course, but I do think it's also just society has changed so much that the work we do is more respected.
Nice. Well, let's take a quick stroll through those 30 years. I'll ask you the same question I ask of all your journalism peers. It strikes me that you were the editor-in-chief of your high school's newspaper. Is that true?
I don't think I ever actually was editor. I was definitely wrote for the school newspaper, and I typeset it, and I took photos for it. But I don't think I ever even wanted to be editor of it, because I think it was more fun for me to do all the other stuff. In fact, even today, the editing part of it is the least of interest to me. I love the actual going out and doing the stories, taking photos, and now even doing videos. So I definitely worked on the high school newspaper. In college, I only wrote for it a little bit. In fact, I mainly covered sports, because the newspaper was pretty dominated by hetero white guys, and I was not, I knew I really wasn't going to be able to push the stories I wanted, so I actually started a feminist newspaper in college.
Lucky
so
you.
I was editor of that, so it kind of was a precursor to starting up other papers later.
What was the name? I feel like it had a cool name.
Well, it actually was the Association of Women Journalists newsletter, so no, it was not sexy or interesting at all, but it was very fun to do, and this was 1980 to 84, and we were covering really tough feminist issues like comparable worth and abortion issues and certainly lesbian issues, lots of interesting stuff at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. I still have copies of those newsletters if Drake ever wants them for their archives, but it was really fun to do. It could have never been written about in the school newspaper at the time.
Did it stir up controversy in putting that content out there?
You know, Drake is a liberal arts school, and Des Moines is a pretty, you know, it's almost like a live and let live. It was sort of live and let live town. There was a couple gay bars, and most people, like, if you kept to yourself, if you didn't bother them, we didn't really have any problems. And on the campus, it was interesting because, you know, I think it feels like long ago, but the feminist movement was already going strong at that point. In fact, it was over a decade old. And so it wasn't really controversial in that sense. I know that Phyllis Schlafly came to talk once and we protested it. And I know there was also a pornography festival on campus. And as a response to it, as a journalist who's against censorship, but still I'm a feminist, we had an alternative film festival on campus at the same time as the porn fest. We had it down the hall, and it had gay sexuality, lesbian sexuality, bisexuality, interracial. We had all these things that were more, they were less violent porn.
Yeah.
We had this was more consensual porn. So that was our feminist answer to the pornography festival that had Deep Throat. And of course, Deep Throat sold out. So everybody came to ours because they couldn't get into that. And so we were educating them about interracial bisexuality. And it was actually, we didn't have any problems because the school allowed a porn fest on campus. What are they going to do? They can't keep us off. So it was kind of a fun time to be there. I don't know what it's like now, but it was really fun to do that.
I love that someone asked you, well, who's in your audience? Well, we got the overflow from the Deep Throat people.
Yes.
That is brilliant. That is brilliant. Well, look, in this day and age, as a college professor, I'm often asked, how do we get our students' job right out of college? According to the Tracy Bain law, you were out of college for like a day and a half, and then you got a job at Gay Life newspaper.
Well, I was willing to work in an alternative environment for no money and bad hours.
There you go.
In journalism these days, I think people are willing to do more of that. But back then, you know, my mom worked in an alternative environment, the Chicago Defender, so I knew she had long hours and no pay. And my stepfather worked at the Tribune, you know, with good pay and benefits and all of that. But he even warned me that as an open lesbian, I probably wouldn't be able to fit in at the Tribune. So I kind of had both those role models in front of me, and I knew the alternative path was more for me if I wanted to do things, write things I cared about. But for sure, people back then in the 80s, not only did a lot of them use fake names when they were writing for gay newspapers, so some of my writers used pseudonyms to protect their careers, but people told me for sure, once you go in alternative, you're not coming out.
Yeah.
You know, you are not going to be able to work in the mainstream. And that was the case in the 70s and 80s, but no more. You know, I think there's a lot of going back and forth. You know, people that write for me write for mainstream and vice versa. So I think it's very different career-wise. In fact, I think it's in many ways a benefit to have a diversity of bylines and different kinds of publications, because mainstream media does value the niche now in a way they didn't before.
Right. Well, barely a year after that, you co-founded the Windy City Times, as I mentioned in your bio. I will say to you what I said to Sarah Toche last week. I don't even understand what it means to co-found a newspaper.
And so in 1985, I was at Gay Life Newspaper with a few other employees, and one of the boyfriends of one of the employees wanted to buy that paper, Gay Life, and that deal fell through. So I was the managing editor by that point. I was 22, and there were three guys, two of them worked at the paper, and then the boyfriend of one of them, who then approached me and said, would you, kind of be our founding managing editor? We really need you to pull the editorial side of the paper together. One of them was an art director, one of them a sales manager, and one of them was going to be the business side. So I would be the editorial managing editor. So the four of us were the co-founders. They put money in. I put sweat equity in. And so I didn't actually get any ownership stake, which probably in the end turned out better based on what happened later. But so we were the four co-founders. A lot of our writers and drivers came along with us. Some didn't, so we just replaced them. And, you know, that's what it kind of means. basically it meant going from one weekly gay newspaper to a couple weeks later starting a new one. The technology was very different back then, so we were borrowing typesetting machines at downtown offices at night. We would sleep overnight just pulling, you know, typesetting on these old topographic Mergenthaler type machines. Then we would bring the copy to the apartment of the publisher.
Wow.
And lay it out. And then a couple months later, we got our own typesetting machine. So we had it in the basement of his apartment building. And then, you know, a year and a half later, I started a different paper. And it was the same process where, in that case, I found people in Chicago that had resources to give us money to start Outlines newspaper. And in that case, then I was a co-founder in financial as well as editorial ways.
Taking a step back, what were you trying to put out there? You know, obviously there was the niche aspect to it. You were catering towards a community. What would you generally say about the content that you were putting out there for consumption?
I felt that, and I still feel this today, is that the goal of our regional LGBT media is to reflect what's going on in the community in any one day or any one week in the community. So that, for me, that means all aspects of LGBT. So from day one at Gay Life Newspaper, I was always like, okay, well, what are the African-American gay community doing?
Yeah.
Why aren't they in the newspaper? How do we cover them better? The Latino community, the women's community, transgender community, even back then, you know, I definitely felt like we need to cover all aspects of the gay LGBT community, you know, gay community back then. So I still feel that today. I feel like in any one week, there are, you know, dozens and dozens of events for us to choose from. This past weekend, I went to a gay wedding, and I went to a street fair, and then I went to yesterday, the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund had their annual benefit here with Anise Parker from Houston.
Nice.
So I will, and any day I can pick many things to go to. Tonight I'm going to a homeless youth documentary that's being hosted by the MacArthur Foundation, and it includes a lesbian's story within that context. So I am still very excited about the amazing stuff that's going on in the LGBT community. Oftentimes the mainstream media covers us pretty one-dimensionally, maybe two-dimensionally if we're lucky. What I get to experience is the 100 different ways in any one day our community is shaped in Chicago and internationally. So it still doesn't, and nothing ever has bored me. I've never run out of stories to do or people to cover. Some of what I think has influenced me over time is that in the 1980s, of course, when I started in 84, there were fewer than 100 AIDS cases diagnosed in Chicago. And
yeah.
At 21 years old, I was covering, you know, funerals and stories that were, you know, like a war reporter would cover. And because of that, I think I always had a sense that whatever I was writing at that point was critical to someone looking at our community 50 years from now, that these faces and these voices were not going to be shelved and put away, that they were going to be covered, unlike they had been 50 years prior, you know, that they had all been silenced. And so I've always had this great sense of urgency to cover as many people as voices as possible. And, you know, I just did an interview with someone in hospice 4 weeks ago, and she died last week. And it was just so critical for me to get her voice, let her have her final say and get that out there, because she had done 30 years of community activism, including on AIDS issues. And I felt like that voice, you know, really wasn't heard in the mainstream. You know, I don't remember her ever getting, you know, mainstream attention for the work she did. So, you know, I feel like I never will run out of stories that make us this multidimensional community that doesn't get that, it gets short shrift in the mainstream almost more than it used to. Like, there was this peak period of time in the around 90 to 98 maybe, that the mainstream media, some of the mainstream papers even had beat reporters covering the gay community. Certainly around AIDS, they finally started to cover it better. But that's gone away now that mainstream media is shrinking.
Right.
So the niche beat reporters are going away. So it's almost more important that we have LGBT media and African-American and Latino media, et cetera, because the mainstream media is not able to cover us the way they used to.
And what do you think about LGBT journalists covering these stories? Is that something that is important to you in the work that you do, or can anyone's voice really do the investigative work here?
I think more of the journalists operating today are more fair on these issues than ever before. You know, the book I did, Gay Press, Gay Power, talks about how horrible it was, even during the peak of the AIDS crisis, how often horrible it was. But this new generation of journalists coming up don't have those same baggage, just like the generation of white journalists that came up after the civil rights movement were better, not perfect, but better. So I think having an LGBT voice in the newsroom is critical, but it's not necessary on every story. The National Gay and Lesbian Journalists Association convention was in Chicago a couple weeks ago, and I said, when I was talking at one point, I said, you know, I think an LGGA's impact in the national movement has really been underappreciated, because when Leroy and Aaron started that group around 1990, there were very few out people in the newsrooms. And, you know, I started in 84, so I know that. My dad worked at the Tribune. There was nobody out then. Randy Schiltz was one of the few across the country. So when Leroy started LGGA, it really started almost to immediately have this impact in the early 90s across the country in newsrooms from the New York Times to the Los Angeles Times, where having an out LGBT peer in the newsroom made it much more difficult for someone to be homophobic in their approach to stories, their decision of who to interview, who to quote, who to feature. All that stuff started to change relatively quickly, given the scheme of things, and it was because LGBTs were in the newsroom. So that doesn't mean you need an LGBT reporter on every LGBT story. I would hope they wouldn't be pigeonholed that way, just like for women to not cover every women's story, quote-unquote.
Right.
But I think it allowed a diversification. And again, I still worry about it. I worry that diversification is shrinking in mainstream newsrooms as they let go of people.
Yeah.
That it's going to be much more difficult to maintain a better balance once you have fewer and fewer people representing any group of people in the newsroom.
Again, listeners, we're here with Tracy Baim, publisher, executive editor at the Windy City Media Group, which produces the Windy City Times. I will ask you the question that keeps coming up over and over as we've had your journalist colleagues on the show in the past few months, and that's about the state of LGBT journalism these days. Now, again, you, as we talked about with Sarah last week, you all got together, a good chunk of you got together in Chicago, and it sounded like a most inspiring time, was it not?
Yes. I mean, I think on the editorial side, I think there's some really terrific stuff happening across the country, as always. Some of it's really online only in terms of blogs or websites that are online only. The difficulty I think we're seeing is national gay print publications are pretty much, they're nowhere near what they were in the 90s.
Right.
The ones that do print very infrequently. So it's that part of the gay press is shadow of its former self. The regional print is also going through this major transformation, and the book Gay Press, Gay Power, I kind of documented it. And as I was finishing the book about a year and a half ago, you know, in the few weeks in the final edit phase, papers kept closing or going online only or going biweekly if they were weekly. So the number of papers there are that are publishing on a regular basis, and I consider, you know, weekly and biweekly to be the strongest in terms of the newspaper format. There are definitely monthlies and bimonthlies that are, you know, more magazine lifestyle format. So the weeklies and biweeklies, there are basically about two dozen left in the entire country.
Wow.
And that is a very difficult number to hear, but it's also something that I worry about a tipping point happening. Because the national advertising buys that happen in our papers are critical to all of us for survival. Some papers get more than others because they're in bigger markets like Chicago, New York. The smaller markets have a more difficult time getting those ad buys, but they get them, even if it's periodic. And so the fewer weeklies and biweeklies there are in this format, the more difficult it's going to be to convince advertising agencies to do those buys, and they'll just go on Logo TV, even though Logo TV might as well be a straight network for what they show.
Indeed.
The straight rerun network with a few RuPaul episodes thrown in. So I think that the regional print is still very critical, and in my mind, of course, I'm biased, but if we lose more of them, it's going to hurt all of us. And that's, I think, why we all have to understand we're in this together in a way we may not have been in the 80s and 90s.
Do you have tips for making regional press more viable? Because it strikes me that the loss of those publications, it's really irreplaceable.
Right, it's irreplaceable. And also, I feel like print has this format that is, not only does it then support the full-time nature of reporting, because blogs often don't.
Right.
You're freelance, and so there's lack of continuity and historical relevance, I think. But print also is archived at museums. Right? I mean, Chicago History Museum has the complete collection of our paper, and other libraries and museums do as well. Digital is not being archived in the same way, I think, tragically so, that nobody's quite figured out. So let's say some blog that's been online for 10 years and done amazing, great stuff, stops, and then that person that was hosting it stops paying their hosting fees. That thing's gone.
Right.
And print is more, permanent in that sense, oddly enough, but So your question was, how do we, you know, tips for survival?
Yeah.
I think in each market, so for us, we've had to, you know, we've always kind of been nimble on our feet because I'm not a business person. So I've always kind of been doing stuff probably a little differently than someone that comes to be a publisher from the business side. I came from the editorial side. So I'm not in it. I've never been in it for the money. So when there's been down years, we just kind of adjust. One of the things we did in 2008, right before the economy collapsed, accidentally, on timing-wise, we were the luckiest paper in the country, I think. We went to a virtual office, and some of the other day papers were like, oh, my God, that's horrible. Even a competitor of ours in Chicago laughed about it, right? They were like, oh, my God, that means they're closing. And we did it because most of our employees worked better from home and were more efficient for us. And it was a quality of life and an economic decision. And, you know, within a few months, the economy collapsed and, you know, gas prices were up. All these other things happened. And we had just cut a huge chunk of our expenses. So we looked to cut things that were less flexible, like rent, as opposed to print. You know, if we have enough ads for a 24-page paper, that's what we print. If we have enough for a 48-page paper, that's what we print. So it's a flexible cost, whereas rent is a hard cost. So we try to have as many flexible costs as we can to survive. And we also really strongly emphasize local LGBT news coverage. And that makes us unique. And what's interesting to me is papers that rely more on Associated Press wire stories or things that are not so specific to local, I think that they're doing a disservice to their readers and they're going to lose them because that kind of stuff you can get online. We try to do stuff in print and online that you're not going to see elsewhere. Not that we will not cover, like, today's court hearing in California on marriage equality. We will cover those stories, absolutely. But our most strong focus is on local news, entertainment, sports kind of stories that nobody else is doing, and therefore we remain relevant. We also try to do things, we do contests, we have this thing called Windy City Guide where we get sponsorship money. We do 30 Under 30 Awards where we acknowledge the next generation of leaders, which, you know, obviously keeps us relevant to a younger generation. And then we did this big conference in May. It was on homeless youth, homeless LGBT youth, where we brought together several hundred people that, including about 100 homeless youth, that participated in discussions about what are we going to do to solve these issues. So we really try to stay engaged in our community from a whole lot of range of places, even though most of it is not about revenue. But it is about relevance. So if you stay relevant, I believe the revenue will come eventually. Maybe not in every area that you're working in, certainly not in homeless youth. That's only a cost area for us. But it definitely shows that you know, you have kind of your finger on the pulse of the community and you're the go-to place to find out what's going on. Like, so that's what's important. You know, it's relevance versus revenue, and eventually I think you'll see success.
Yeah. I realize as I'm having these conversations really over the past couple of months, and we've been focusing on LGBT journalism, I didn't realize I was as much of a purist as I thought I was. And I'm kind of working through that idea of who is a journalist and who puts together stories for a compendium site online. And that there really is a difference between these two. And I would imagine that came up quite a bit there in Chicago when you all gathered.
The aggregators?
Exactly.
You mean aggregators?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, we get our stuff aggregated all the time. Sometimes we cooperate and sometimes it's against our will and we have to threaten them. You know, especially if they like take basically 90% of the story and at the bottom say, oh, by the way, a lot of this was from Windy City Times. You know,
right.
Ridiculous. I think a lot of the aggregation stuff, that's what's most infuriating. Sure, take 2-3 paragraphs and then link to us. We love links. Links are showing your relevance on Google and we understand that. And certainly when we don't do a lot of aggregation at all, but if there's a story locally, for example, that we cannot get original sourcing on, Daily Herald recently just had a piece, for example, and we wanted to get something up, so we ran 2 paragraphs and linked to them and said, you know, for more information. And that's great. I mean, I think it's a wonderful service that we can do when we don't have the opportunity to do original reporting. But the aggregation out there that happens on some of the larger sites that are basically just cobbling stuff and not shooting original. I was just saying this to my partner. You know, we covered the Victory Fund event yesterday. So I took video, my dad took photos, and we had a reporter there. So we had 3 people there covering it, 100 photos, 5 videos, and a 700- or 800-word story. That's original work that we did. That kind of stuff sometimes then gets taken and posted on some other sites, which I'm not going to name, as if they were there. And most people are not going to go to the links. They're not going to bother. And if you take more than 1 or 2 things from a site, and then it basically looks to the reader like you were there. And that's what really frustrates me more than anything. I think aggregation can be done in an effective way for everybody, but I just feel like, for advertisers' sake even, that those kind of readers will come and go. The readers that get it from the more meatier sites that are doing the original reporting, to me, are more valuable to an advertiser than ones that just hop from one to the next, looking at little snippets of things. I just feel like if I was an advertiser, I would want to be at the more engaged site.
Well, let me take my annoyance one step further and hopefully don't annoy you because I respect you too much. But what's interesting to me, too, about this is that the heads of some of these aggregate sites, again, we're not a salacious show, so we're not trying to be negative, you know, about anyone specifically. But I'm kind of fascinated that some of the heads of these sites are routinely the folks who are invited to be the talking LGBT heads and represent everything that's going on in the LGBT community and media when, in fact, they were pulling from other sources.
Right. I mean, there's some exceptions to that. I'll give a good example. Michelangelo Signorelli works at one of those sites that aggregates a lot. But he does a lot of original writing and reporting of his own, both on his radio show and for Huffington Post. So I think he is an example of how it should be.
There you go.
And there are people at BuzzFeed that are paid full-time and do original investigative pieces, and that's awesome. You know, I think that, in fact, because there's so much money in those sites, there are eventually going to be more people writing about LGBT stuff in a full-time salaried basis at those places. At the same time, you have a ton of people writing for free for places like Huffington Post.
Right.
That, it's very frustrating because then we're competing and we don't pay very much, but we pay for our freelance writers. And, but they can get far more exposure on Huffington Post for their brand or their career or whatever that might mean. So it is, it's kind of frustrating in that sense that we'll be paying for a piece and then it gets aggregated. Or we have a full-time salary and it gets aggregated. But I think the stuff that they're doing on original reporting, which I know BuzzFeed says they're going more towards, is terrific. I think Huffington Post, it would be great given how much money they're worth with that AOL, was it AOL?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's just no reason they should not be paying for the news stories that are posted, all of them. Sure, some of the guest columns, especially those that are really self-serving for promotional purposes, absolutely, you don't need to pay for that kind of stuff. We don't either. If we have a guest writer that gives us some tips about, you know, legal issues or something, we don't pay for that. But for some of the news stuff or the, you know, investigative pieces, things like that, I think it would just up the level for people all the way around.
Nice. Well, I feel like I would like to give you the opportunity to extol the virtues of Chicago, a place I have never been to. I'm going for the first time in a few weeks. I'm most excited. My assumption is if there's a gay Chicago tourism board out there, you, Tracy, have been the head of it for a very long time.
No, I did found the Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce in 96, I think it was. But I haven't been, I'm just a member of it now. I'm not part of it. And I was co-vice chair of the Gay Games when it was in Chicago in 2006. So during that 96 to 2006 era, I probably was doing a lot more of that, pushing of Chicago on that level. I'm born and raised in Chicago, so I'm totally biased. I think it's, you know, an amazing city. I love other cities like Austin and Madison and certainly love to visit San Francisco, New York. But Chicago to me, there's a couple things that I really love about it. One is I think having the change of seasons is a good thing. Today is an absolutely beautiful fall day in Chicago. Although last winter just about did it.
Oh yeah.
People I know. It's pretty brutal. But with global warming, we're next to a fresh water source, so that's also a good thing. The other thing about Chicago, different than a lot of cities, especially Boston, New York, and San Francisco, and LA, is how geographically accessible it is. We do, you know, you can get places in Chicago on public transportation very easily, and also even driving. Like, it's a very accessible city to get to things. We have this amazing lakefront that has museums and bike paths, and you can walk so many places around the city just like you can in New York. So I just feel like it has the culture downtown all throughout the neighborhoods, and you also have these LGBT areas if you want to hang out there, but you don't have to. There's just so much else you can do in Chicago, and, you know, I never run out of stuff that's interesting to do. I'm not so much a foodie, but I know that it's also known for that, and certainly amazing theater and arts and all of that. So it's a great place to visit, certainly. I heard we're number one ranked at the Closeted Gay Guys visiting in the United States. We're the number one city for Closeted Gay Guys. I think it's because there's a lot of conventions here, and they can have the cover of being here on business, but it's also a great place for people who are out.
We here in Cleveland are looking to compete with you for that title as the Republican National Convention comes here next year. So we're...
Yeah, I was just there for the Gay Games opening ceremonies. Yeah, I was in, because I was co-vice chair of the Gay Games in Chicago, and some of our people helped Cleveland, Rob Smitherman in particular. He was our sports guy, and he was the sports guy for Cleveland. I felt like I really wanted to show support, and my partner's from Akron. So I went to the opening ceremony, and it was really fabulous. I think they really just did a really terrific job. They were smaller than ours, but I think they scaled to made it fit for that, and did a really terrific job. I didn't get to stay for the whole week, but I loved opening ceremonies, and I certainly love that area. I go there a lot because of my partner.
It was incredible. It was incredible, and as I said last week, it's amazing to me and makes me so happy at how many rainbow flags are still up in places that I wouldn't have thought they would still be up weeks and weeks later. So it's been just for visible identifiers. Well, we have to ask you about the LGBTQ trivia game, That's So Gay, which, by the way, tell everyone how easy it was to get that title trademarked.
Well, we got turned down on That's So Gay initially from the Trademark Commission. And what's really funny, I mean, we appealed it. I appealed it. It cost me money, and so I was a little hesitant to appeal because I thought for sure I would lose. But then, you know, I found all these places where it was listed positive and negative, and the, you know, so I thought we could maybe have a challenge. So my lawyer's working on the challenge, and what's really funny is we won this summer. It, you know, there was an appeal and then a public, an opportunity for the public to comment, and there were, you know, it wasn't challenged by the public. And so we got approved, and that was the same time that the Redskins got disapproved.
Oh, wow.
So I thought it was kind of funny. But so, yeah, it's a 2,400-question trivia game. I came out last December in time for the holidays. It was kind of one of those things where I worked on it for about a year because I had all this in my mind, like all this trivia that I just wanted to get out of my mind. And, of course, I had editors on it to fact-check me and did a lot of research as well. It wasn't like I knew for sure all the answers. But I just felt like it was a great one-stop way to get all of throughout history from, you know, Sappho to Tchaikovsky to Laverne Cox to get all of that into a game that could be a fun way for the family. And we tested it with some groups, including my 80-year-old father, straight father, and he would often win the games because a lot of it's basically culture, right?
Yeah.
You know who Tchaikovsky is, and you might not know the answer to that question because there's so many hints that have nothing to do with the fact that he was gay. So that's what I tried to do with it, and I think it's a game, right? It's basically a bingo game that's trivia. But the book itself, I feel like I'm probably going to put it out just as a book in case, you know, if people just want to have an LGBT trivia book because it'll be cheaper for them to get. But the game right now is on Amazon, and eventually maybe it'll be an electronic form. I got the trademark for both electronic and for a physical game, and I've given it, donated it to youth groups in Chicago, and we've done, you know, game nights at various events where we give away prizes. It was just kind of a really fun thing to do. To keep interested in journalism, I always feel like I have to keep another side of my brain active in either movies or trivia or something in order not to burn out.
Yeah.
So it kind of works that way.
Well, I ordered a copy today so that we can play it with This Course Is So Gay this semester at Baldwin-Wallace University.
Excellent.
So we're pretty excited.
Excellent.
That's what we're going to do on the last day. I'll let you know if I win.
Terrific.
I'm kind of hoping. Well, let's conclude with, we would love for you to give more advice. We have our listeners write in all the time, and particularly those who want to go into journalism, because we do try to feature so many different members of the LGBT news media on our show, because that's our commitment. Give us some advice. Now, yours is just an amazing story because there's such a fearlessness to, I don't know if that's what you felt as you were progressing through your career, but there is this fearlessness of getting right out of college and just throwing yourself into it. And certainly the content, as you mentioned, that you were covering is not content that we would, at its very baseline, expect a 21, 22-year-old to cover and do it well. Give us advice for our young listeners who want to get into LGBT journalism. What do they need to know?
Well, first, you know, when I was in journalism school, my teachers definitely didn't even, you know, think that there could be any career like this for sure. I mean, they were like, you know, you're not going to want to be out. You're not going to want to, you know, there's no alternative journalism really career. And so I didn't even know that when I graduated that there was even a gay newspaper in Chicago. My mother heard about the newspaper, so that's how I heard about Gay Life newspaper. And back then, of course, you had to actually print a newspaper to put out a newspaper. What's great now is you absolutely don't need any of those tools to put out a newspaper. And that's what's fantastic these days, because I feel like that there's endless opportunities now to be a journalist and to practice your trade and get it right, and create a voice for yourself. There may not, and I, you know, I speak to some journalism classes around the Chicago area, and I say that, you know, you're probably going to have a better chance of getting a job than a 40-year-old journalist right now, because you're going to have a lot more tools, YouTube, you know, videos and things like that that you can do. But eventually some other technology is going to come along and someone else younger is going to have an opportunity. So what you have to be able to do is adapt. And I do video, and I, you know, even though I'm 51 years old, I do all the social media for our company, the Twitter, the Facebook, and everything. So continuing to adapt to whatever that new technology is important, but don't be, not being always going after that as the solution, right? We do stuff very slow and deliberate. We don't just jump into Tumblr. We're not on Tumblr. If there's no scheme that we feel like plays into our, what works for us. Like, we don't just jump into a new technology unless we know it works for what we do. So we try not to waste time. But the most important thing is you may have to have another 9-to-5 job, but you can always be a journalist. And that's what I told myself when I graduated college, when I was told that I probably wouldn't have a career in journalism. I was like, okay, that's okay. I can typeset, because I thought that would be a great future, which it was even worse. But I knew how to operate all these complicated typesetting machines, and I thought, okay, well, I can do that 9-to-5. And in fact, the first month I graduated and the first 6 months while I was part-time, how I made my real money was typesetting in Chicago for Chicago ad firms at night. So I did something else 9-to-5 and then, or 5-to-9 at night. And then I did my journalism. And I think that's the case today, where many of us journalists will be more like musicians, where some of us get to do it full-time, but most of us do it part-time and in the nooks and crannies of our time. But still get to do that, because I'm a journalist to my core. And if I had to sling hamburgers again at McDonald's, I would do that in order to do the journalism.
Right.
And if you have it in your blood and your passion, you will always be able to be a journalist, no matter who's writing the paycheck for you. You will always be able to be a journalist. And that's very different than most other professions. You know, you can't be a doctor like that, right? So I feel if you have this calling to be a musician or a journalist, we are very fortunate. And that nobody can really dictate what we do outside of those, that other job we do, to go for it. But you have to be willing to sacrifice a lot, you know, financially and career wise. But I really feel like it was the absolute right choice for me. I would have never fit in to the Tribune, or any other kind of environment like that. I would have lasted a couple of years at most, and then I wouldn't be doing journalism. So I'm really glad that I took this alternative path.
We're really glad, too. Listeners, you can stroll on over to WindyCityTimes.com and read everything that's happening there. You can go to Amazon and type in Tracy Baim, and you can find all of her materials there. I highly encourage you not to privilege one of your texts over another, Tracy, but I have assigned Gay Press Gay Power in a previous course of mine, and the conversations that it started and the eye-opening, the actual physical eye-opening that happened in class as we went through just the incredible history of LGBT media, of LGBT press, and that regional voice was invaluable to what I was trying to do in the classroom. So definitely check out Gay Press,
great.
Gay Power.
That's great to hear. Thank you so much for doing that.
Well, hey, I'm using you as a jumping off point, so thank you. I have to tell you, I've been following the Windy City Times for just so many years, and all the work that you've put out there. You are so steadfast and so resolute in putting out this regional voice that so obviously is about more than a region. You know, it's not just about one part of the country. It's not about a few folks in Chicago. It represents so much more than that. It represents people who are really using their voice, and you are featuring these voices. And it really is such an inspiration to the rest of us. My hope is that you know how much you inspire the rest of us out there.
Well, I want to cry. Thank you so much. It means a lot coming from Ohio. You know, I mean, like I said, I feel like we operate in this bubble in Chicago's LGBT community, so it's wonderful to talk to people outside of that.
No, it's you're an inspiration. You're an inspiration. Again, folks, WindyCityTimes.com. Go to Amazon, type in Tracy Baim. Tracy, what an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Like when you told me I
weeks, and we are back with some time left on this week's episode to cover some of the latest LGBT news out there. And here it is. The U.S. Supreme Court will consider as many as 5 statewide challenges to marriage bans in its upcoming private conference, the first of its new session. This news comes to you via theadvocate.com. The court will decide whether to weigh in on petitions from Indiana and Wisconsin, Oklahoma, Utah, and Virginia. The Wall Street Journal reported that meetings to decide the court's schedule begin on September 29th in private conference. After that conference, the justices will then add those cases they decide to hear to the docket for the upcoming term, which begins October 6th. This, my friends, this would be a countdown going on. Court watchers have anticipated, and some have even predicted, that the court will take up at least one of the cases for review. If the court takes on all of those cases, then ultimately rules in favor of marriage equality more than 65 million Americans. 65 million Americans could find themselves living in states where same-sex couples would have the right to marry. This quote comes to you from Peggy Tomsic of the Salt Lake City law firm Magleby and Greenwood. She said in a statement, "The state of Utah and the plaintiff couples agree that it is important the Supreme Court take this case and settle the constitutional questions at stake, questions that matter so much to the families we represent and to so many others across the country." And that's the law firm that is representing same-sex couples in the Utah case. This quote comes to you from Mary Bonauto of the Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders. She said, quote, "It is time to end the legal bans that keep committed couples from standing up and making the unique pledges of marriage to each other, pledges that would allow their families protection and security everywhere in this country." Holy cow, we are coming down to it now. So we will see what the Supreme Court decides, which cases they will take on, what they will decide, what's going to happen on October 6th. We all have to stay tuned. It's going to be inescapable, which is a good thing because we want press for this. And, you know, hopefully the Supreme Court will go the way of most judges in the country at this point, with the exception of the one that we told you about last week. And I'm still a little bit reeling from that judge saying that marriage equality is not a good thing because it would be against intact families. I'm still stuck on that word, intact. It still bugs me. Can you tell? I'm talking about it a week later. That said, we will see what the Supreme Court takes on and whether they agree with the vast majority of judges who have decided in favor of marriage equality in the past year. So that's happening. Some news to you from the Gay Politics Report. The Human Rights Campaign President Chad Griffin, did you guys see this? Apologized to the transgender community during a speech in Atlanta last week, at the end of last week, expressing regret over the group's decision to back a non-trans inclusive version of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act in 2008. During his keynote address at the Southern Comfort Conference, Griffin acknowledged his role in causing the divide between HRC and the trans community. He said this, quote, "What happens to trans people is absolutely central to the LGBT struggle, and as the nation's largest LGBT civil rights organization, HRC has a responsible to do that struggle justice," end quote. There has been a lot of commentary there on the Facebook and in the blogs about Chad Griffin's comments. Did they come too little too late? Did they just come too late? Are we including our trans brothers and sisters too late in the process? Whereas, can we just go with the part that, okay, yeah, they should have been included much earlier. Now let's do the work together and extend protections to everybody. I have said in class, I've said on this show a million times over, just pointed out the hypocrisy in leaving off the T in order to get the LGB protections passed. And it's always been abominable. It's always been icky. And the T should have been included all along. That said, we are where we are now, and Chad Griffin is trying to make amends, and we will see. We judge these by actions, not by words. So let's keep an eye on Human Rights Campaign if they indeed do include the T as we move forward. Some fun stories for you. After 72 years together, an Iowa same-sex couple has tied the knot. I love this story. Vivian Boyack and Alice Dubes married last Saturday in Davenport, Iowa, 72 years after their relationship began. The women first met in their hometown of Yale before moving to Davenport in 1947, where Boyack worked as a teacher and Dubes staffed the payroll department at a local newspaper. After a ceremony attended by family and close friends at the First Christian Church of Davenport, the couple said, I love this, they said they believe it is never too late to start a new chapter in life. Congratulations to Vivian Boyack and Alice Dubes, who tied the knot last week after 72 years together. I love it. I love it. There are great things happening in the Obama administration, things that we don't take note of and never would have happened under the previous administration. The White House last week named Megan Smith to the position of Chief Technology Officer of the United States. Smith is an out lesbian. She joined Google in 2003. She is expected to focus on revamping the administration's information technology policy initiatives. So congratulations there to Megan Smith, who was appointed to that pretty darn important position of Chief Technology Officer. Further, the Department of Justice announced this week that they have promoted Stuart Delery, a senior official in its civil division, to replace Tony West as acting associate attorney general. The change makes Delery, who is openly gay, the department's third highest ranking official and the most senior out LGBT person to ever serve in the Department of Justice. Love that story. Over in Wisconsin, a Wisconsin school district has adopted a policy allowing transgender students to use the bathroom and locker room of the gender with which they identify if it's okay with their parents and principals. The Janesville School Board adopted the policy to bar discrimination based on gender identity. Craig High School teacher Katie Hess, who advises the Gay Straight Alliance, said she knows of 5 or 6 transgender students at the school and regularly hears club members talk about bullying and harassment that they have experienced. This is what Hess said, quote, I have to commend the school board and the school district for stepping up. The Gay Straight Alliance and a lot of people were really pleased to see that. Hess said that her brother was born a female but identified as male, and high school was a tough time for him. She went on to say, quote, my brother wouldn't go to the bathroom in high school because he wouldn't go in the girls' bathroom, but he couldn't go in the guys' bathroom because he looked like a girl at the time. So just little things like that, where you're holding your bathroom all day long, are things we take for granted. So great progress there in Wisconsin, of all places. Following up on the progress of Michael Sam, who again was drafted now to the practice squad for the Dallas Cowboys, there's a poll out there on that Gay Politics report. The poll asks, will Michael Sam play in an NFL game this year? And 65% believe that yes, he will play in an NFL game this year. I love that optimism. Often these polls don't show that, and they're a little bit depressing. 21% said no, he will not play in an NFL game this year, and 13.37%, they're not sure. They're just not sure. There was another poll out there that I was fascinated by, also from that Gay Politics Report Smart Brief. It asked, quote, when do you think the Republican Party will nominate a pro-marriage equality presidential candidate? And 52% said 2024 or later, which was the latest possible option on there. 32% said by the year 2020, 9% were not sure, and less than 7% said 2016. I don't know about that. I don't think I agree with that. I am still hoping that the Republicans have learned, you know, maybe a little bit from the 2012 presidential election, when it was very clear that if you alienate most of the country and you are against more than you are for, you're not going to win. And so we're getting to that point, and we're going to see what happens. We still have 2 years left to go, whether we will find out if there will be more of a mainstream Republican candidate who reflects the majority of the country who believe in marriage equality. So we will see. We're going to see in just a short amount of time. We have to also see who's going to be running for the Democratic ticket. Will it be Hillary Clinton? That'd be pretty exciting. I'm all for that. There's a clip that I urge you to watch. It's a Sesame Street clip. If you just go to the YouTube and type in Sesame Street and Janelle Monae, J-A-N-E-L-L-E-M-O-N-A-E, a great singer-songwriter out there who is just a pleasure to watch, who, by the way, I had not heard of until one of our guests on this very show introduced me to Janelle Monae. She made an appearance on Sesame Street singing a song called Power of Yet. Now, why am I talking about this on This Show Is So Gay? Because she is wearing her tuxedo as she always does, and it's just an amazing image. It's an amazing image for Sesame Street, which is, you know, the most widely watched program by everyone, I think. I think it's everyone. Everyone watches Sesame Street. I still watch clips every now and then. That's okay, right? You guys do too, right? To see Janelle Monáe, a female presenting figure wearing what some would consider to be male-identified clothes, which we can fight against those stereotypes later on, but to see a woman wearing a tuxedo on Sesame Street is just the greatest image. And again, as we teach our youth, that conformity in dress does not have to be the law of the land. Girls do not have to wear this. Boys do not have to wear this. Sesame Street, extraordinarily influential in children's education. Having Janelle Monáe on Sesame Street wearing a tuxedo is fantastic. Also, the song Power of Yet is brilliant. It's words to live by. I love it. I love it. And finally, our congratulations to Sarah Gilbert. Sarah Gilbert, who is on The Talk, out lesbian, formerly from Roseanne, who I loved her on Roseanne. I grew up watching her on Roseanne. I love her on Roseanne. Well, they have announced, Sarah Gilbert and her partner Linda Perry from the Four Non-Blondes, they have announced that they are expecting their first child together. The Talk co-hosts were in the middle of a Facing Your Fear segment of the show when Gilbert explained that she couldn't take on a dare to stretch out on a bed of nails and have a cinder block broken over her stomach, which apparently is a thing. She said there was no way she could do it. She said, quote, I really do believe in facing your fears and doing things that make you uncomfortable, but I actually can't do the dare because I'm pregnant. Gilbert and Perry were wed in March of this year at a ceremony fit for a rock star, and the Talk co-hosts were ecstatic when she broke the pregnancy news on the air. There's such a great picture of it that you can find on Twitter. It's on the Talk's Twitter page, which is at @thetalk_CBS. And it's just a joyous picture. And again, the more media representation we have of our LGBT brothers and sisters, just the better. The more out folks we have, particularly in the media, it really does make a difference. It really does. You never know who you're reaching. So just want to put that out there. Our huge, huge thanks to Tracy Baim of the Windy City Times. My gosh, folks, if you are not inspired to get out there and use your voice regionally, I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle. I get that there are all these folks out there who are trying to capture a more national LGBT voice, but I now worry, especially because Tracy Baim told us about the dearth of regional LGBT newspapers, I worry that we are losing that regional voice, which is so important, so that the voice in Northampton, Massachusetts, shout out Northampton, and the voice of Brattleboro, Vermont is very different than the voice, the LGBT voice of Cleveland. So if you have that opportunity to get your regional LGBT voice out there, it's so important. We start locally. We start locally because that's one way to definitely make a difference. We have amazing guests coming up next week. As always, if you have guest suggestions, send them on over to ken@theshowisogay.com. I love getting your emails. I am almost all caught up. I'm not quite there yet. This semester's kicking my butt a little bit, but thankfully another new episode for you this week, and we got another new episode for you next week. So we are going to keep on chugging along. You guys get out there, whether you are starting up a newspaper in your region or you are announcing your pregnancy on national TV, no matter what it is that you are doing, get out there and use your voice to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you are out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Every time I feel this way, this old familiar sinking, I will lay my troth down by the water where the river will never run dry. Hallelujah. As you have. shall you receive. So take from me these troubles, bring me sweet release, where the river will never run dry. Alleluia,
myself be
alleluia.
Troubles down by the wall.